From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Nuruddin Farah has the distinction of being the first Somali novelist, but his writing brought him a death sentence from the dictator of Somalia. Farah is now teaching at Brown University, where he's organized a conference of African writers, which opened today. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Farah about why his government and his family opposed his writing. Also, if you're looking for some good media criticism on how shallow TV news can be, you might try the comic strip This Modern World. If you're cynical about all the merchandising spin-offs from the comics pages, This Modern World has something for you, too. Coming up, we meet the cartoonist Dan Perkins. And John Leonard reviews Carlos Fuentes' new novel, The Campaign. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Syria's foreign minister has reacted angrily to a new Israeli settlement created today on the Golan Heights. Israel captured the land from Syria during the 1967 war. Syria insists the Golan Heights be returned as a condition for progress in bilateral talks with Israel. Meanwhile, the Israeli delegation to the peace conference has returned home. Patricia Golan reports from Jerusalem.
The Israelis returned, proclaiming they had conveyed Israel's message to the world, even if nothing of substance had been decided. Delegation members were encouraged that after 43 years of bloodshed, they had finally talked to their Arab neighbors across the table. One representative said the first page in the Book of Peace had been written. But not everyone agreed. Housing Minister Ariel Sharon, who took part in today's dedication ceremony of the new Golan Heights settlement, said that Israel may have gained some PR in Madrid, but its participation in the conference was politically a colossal failure. Palestinians in the Israeli-occupied territories held rallies today in support of the peace process, and in a change of tactics, radical Islamic groups opposed to the conference promised not to use violence against the Palestinian negotiators. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
The Senate began debate today on whether to confirm President Bush's nominee, Robert Gates, as the next director of the CIA. Although Gates has been scrutinized over the past 4.5 months by the Senate Intelligence Committee, members say they will continue to watch him closely if he is confirmed. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
If the nomination is approved, Gates will take over the CIA at a turbulent time. It faces up to a 25% budget cut over the next 3 years and will be restructured to reflect a world that's been changed by the collapse of communism. But Senator David Boren, chairman of the Intelligence Committee, says despite concern over Gates' performance in the past, he's the best man to oversee the agency.
Like all of us, he is not the same person he was 5 or 10 years ago. I'm convinced that he's learned from his mistakes, and in fact that he will be an even better director because he has passed through difficult times.
Boren acknowledged today that there are a large number of CIA employees who are worried about the return of Gates, and he pledged to protect those who testified against Gates during the hearings, saying he would intervene at the slightest hint of retribution. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Several major medical organizations today criticized federal efforts to list risky procedures for doctors with AIDS. Groups representing dentists, surgeons, and orthopedic surgeons told Centers for Disease Control officials there isn't enough scientific evidence to determine which procedures are exposure-prone and therefore unsafe. But the nation's biggest health organization, the American Medical Association, agreed with the government. Stocks closed lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped nearly 11 points. This is National Public Radio News. The Ukrainian government today agreed to join the new Soviet Economic Union. The announcement is a breakthrough for President Gorbachev's goal to bring all 12 remaining Soviet republics into the new organization. The Ukraine is the Soviet Union's second most populous republic. It's also a major food producer. In the Midwest, sales of single-family homes continued at pre-recession levels this summer. The National Realtors Association said today more homes sold in the Midwest because the region is more affordable. Nationwide, the median house price was just over $100,000. In Peoria, Illinois, the median price was $58,000. In the nation's only Senate race, Pennsylvania voters tomorrow will choose between former U.S. Attorney General Dick Thornburg and Harris Wofford, the Democrat appointed to fill the seat until the election. Doug Schlatter of member station WHYY reports the race has turned into a tight contest.
Most political analysts are saying this race is too close to call. 2 months ago, Dick Thornburg, a former two-term Pennsylvania governor, was nearly 40 points ahead of Harris Wofford. But recent polls give Thornburg only a 1-5 point edge. What apparently closed that gap is Wofford centering his campaign on national health care, a position which seemed to have struck a chord with voters.
I think the mandate that I will have if I have victory on November 5th will be number one, to get action on national health insurance, and like unto it, action to get us out of this recession and to get our economy off dead center where it's now stuck.
In the last week, Thornburg has also adopted a position on national health care, though not as extensive as Wofford's. Both sides have also pumped millions of dollars into negative TV ads. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Schlatter in Philadelphia.
The Yugoslav army increased attacks on Croatia today. European community-sponsored peace talks begin tomorrow in The Hague. The vice president of the ruling Serbian party said today his republic could not accept what the EC wants. I'm Laura Kanoy, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A festival of African writing opened today at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. 20 writers from 10 African nations and scholars from around the world will be reading and discussing work at public sessions throughout the week. There will also be presentations of African films, music, and dance. One of the main organizers of the conference is the Somali writer Nuruddin Farah, who's teaching this semester at Brown. Most of us have scant knowledge of his country, which is part of the northeastern horn of Africa. Since independence in 1960, its people have been the victims of dictatorship, civil war, and famine. In the 70s, Farah's writing was met with a death sentence from the dictator of Somalia, Siad Barre, who lost power earlier this year. Although Farah has lived outside of his country for more than 15 years, he continues to write about Somalia in novels and plays, and he considers the entire African continent his home. He was based most recently in Uganda. Farah speaks Somali, Arabic, English, Italian, and French, but he writes mainly in English. He's been criticized for this, as have other African writers who write in English, and Farah says this issue will be discussed at the conference.
What matters is not the language in which you write, but the politics of one's writing, the content of what one writes in these books, and the ideology informing the writing.
Now, you're the first writer from Somalia, the first novelist to write in English. And in fact, some African writers have criticized you for that, saying that, you know, English is the language of the colonialists and that the people of Somalia can't really read your books if your books are written in English. What's your response to that criticism?
Well, the first response is that when I started writing in English, Somali, the language which I, my mother tongue, had no orthography.
No written language?
No written script. It had no script, and you couldn't write in Somali. You could only speak Somali, or you could compose oral poetry in Somali. And because I was interested in writing, and because I was brought up in the written tradition and not in the oral, I started writing not only in English, but I started writing in Arabic and thought of writing in Italian. My concern was actually to put down things on paper. And it didn't really matter what language I wrote in. What mattered was that I wrote down the things that were on my mind. Now, in 1965, when I first published my novella, Somali had no orthography. In fact, Somali had no orthography, no script until 1972. So if anyone expected that I would be holding my pen in midair, waiting for the Somali people to improvise or invent a script, I suppose one could say they're being unfair.
You know, I'm thinking how hard it is for me to really comprehend what it must have been like to want to be a writer and to live in a culture where the native tongue had no written language. It must have been, you know, very difficult, almost schizophrenic.
It is schizophrenic. In point of fact, I wrote an article called The Schizophrenia of My Childhood, which was published in the Times Literary Supplement. There is also a great joy in watching a baby being born, because writing is comparable, I think, to giving birth to a living being. Now, not only writing in the real sense of the term, but also all forms of literature, as a matter of fact, all forms of art. My mother was a poet, an oral poet, and I used to watch her when I was very small. I used to watch her pace back and forth as she composed her poetry, which would eventually be chanted by other women. So my inspiration, the first inspiration, if there was any, came from my mother's commitment to literary composition. Now, my mother was composing her poetry in the oral tradition, and so did my grandfather and my great-grandfather. They were all poets. And it was expected that somebody in our family would pick up the baton, as it were, that was passed on from generation to generation and continue producing some form of literary composition. It didn't, therefore, really matter to me what language I wrote in. And if you taught me today, if you taught me a new language, and I was sufficiently confident in writing in it, I wouldn't hesitate to do so.
What did your mother think about you writing things down on paper? It was something she wasn't used to.
Well, my mother didn't take it very seriously until after it started getting me into trouble and the whole family because of the politics of the country. And then, and only then, did she say, this is dangerous, you must stop it, you mustn't play with fire. For her, writing was also something that took me away from her, as it were. And the reason is because reading novels and also writing fiction requires a certain amount of self-isolation. And this self-isolation meant, in actual fact, that you were participating in an act in which the community, or from which the community, was excluded. Now, this was the thing that my mother disapproved of. And the reason was because in oral tradition, the poet composes the poem in the tradition in which it is set, and then somebody else picks it up and chants it. Another one dances to it. So it becomes a communal participation. The act of novel writing requires a completely different form of literary commitment. And this, again, was one of the things that angered more and more, not only my mother, but very many other of my would-be friends, because novel writing takes a great deal of time, a lot more than it does to compose a poem.
Were you angry with your family and friends? Did you feel that they were not making an attempt to really understand you?
Well, I was unhappy with the way many of them treated me, and the reason is because I was treated like a pariah at some point, and especially when my writing became more and more political, and when a death sentence was passed on me, and when my immediate family, and this is during the reign of the tyrannical head of state of Somalia for 21 years, Siad Barre, when the immediate members of the family were being, harassed and their jobs put at risk. And everybody began to think that, in fact, writing was a very dangerous vocation. But I wasn't the only one who was involved in this literature of protest, if you want to call it, because some of the oral poets were also involved in participating in this communal self-assertion, fighting against dictatorship.
If you're just joining us, my guest is the Somali writer Nuruddin Farah, and he's teaching now at Brown University, and he's just organized a festival of African writing, which is bringing African writers from around the world, writers from Africa and writers who have been living in exile. What kind of ideas were you expressing in your early writing that ended up getting you a death sentence in your country?
Well, it began, I suppose, with my first novel, which was, on the surface of it, less political than the other ones. It began when I first started linking societal dictatorship to political dictatorship. And by societal dictatorship, I mean my first novel, From a Crooked Drip, was about how women were treated by our society in the most savage manner. And therefore, the point that I was trying to make in the first novel, which became clearer and clearer as I wrote more and more about Somalia, was that a society which treated its women in that cruel manner could not be expected to be liberal and democratic.
So you were saying that the patriarchal authoritarian structure of traditional culture in Somalia was a kind of breeding ground for an authoritarian form of government.
Precisely, to the point where, for example, even if there has been change in the leadership of, let's say, a country like Nigeria, even if there have been so many different heads of state that came and went, so many different governments, there hasn't been any sign of democratization. And the reason is because the Nigerian person or the Somali person has not been restructured mentally to adopt himself or herself to the new mood.
You are considered the African writer who has embraced women's rights the most and who embraced it first. And I wonder what made you think about initially the status of women in your culture.
Well, it goes back to the Somali oral tradition in which poets very often took as metaphor whenever they wrote about a very difficult situation. They always took women as a symbol, as a metaphor. So that was perhaps one of the first seeds which began to germinate in my thoughts. The other is the fact that ever since I was small and have shown interest in writing, I have always taken a great dislike of the things of my own autobiography. In other words, I've often thought that my life is the least interesting of lives being led. The first time, therefore, that I started writing afforded me the possibility of taking on the challenge of distancing myself from the subject on whom or on which I was writing, and who was better than a young woman, since I was a young man, and who was better than a young nomadic woman, since I was born and brought up in the city. I was interested in the contrast between persons, and I was interested in examining and analyzing the advantages and disadvantages that accrued from being born male and advantaged, or being born female and disadvantaged, right from the start. And remember, I'm the fourth son of a family of 10 children, and that meant that it's only after me that my mother began giving birth to daughters. And so we, the boys, were more generously pampered than the girls. In point of fact, my father refused to send my sisters to school, and the poor things had to wait until we, the boys, were grown up enough to be able to send them to school.
Your brothers agreed with you that they should go to school, that your sisters should go to school?
Yes. Well, I'm the fourth son, so the ones who were older than I am also agreed with that, and therefore we put all our efforts into giving them the opportunities that they missed because they were born girls and not boys.
My guest is Somali writer Nuruddin Farah, who's teaching this semester at Brown University. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Somali writer Nuruddin Farah is my guest. Do you consider yourself in exile now? Is the death sentence still in effect?
No, the death sentence is no longer in effect. And I don't consider myself in exile in the same way as I used to before. It is unfortunate, however, that I'm unable to go back to Somalia because of the civil war, the savage civil war that's taken place there. When a people have been denied political self-expression, when they've been deprived of a self-will for so many years, people forget how to express themselves. Tolerating other people's views and living in harmony with other views.
When was the last time you were in Somalia?
I was last in Somalia in 1974, 17, 18 years ago. And I left Somalia for Britain because in those days I was more interested in theatre. And then went to train with the Royal Court Theatre in London as a director trainee. And it was during my stay in England that I published a novel which seemed to have angered Siad Barre's dictatorship. And I hadn't considered that possible. In other words, I hadn't thought that a novel would create so much anger in a dictator that he would give me a minimum of about 30 years if I returned.
You know, it's surprising about how angry the dictator was about your novel. If you were writing in English, probably most Somalis couldn't read the book. Was he worried more about international opinion?
No, I don't think, you see, let me address myself first to the question of reading and who reads books.
Yes, whether, please.
Let's, for example, take the fact that Somalia had no orthography until 1972. So the people who read anything in Somalia at that time, and also who read anything in Somalia today, are people who've been educated in European languages.
Mm-hmm.
Novel reading is comparable to a technology which needs to be developed. And so not everybody who knows how to read and write reads fiction because it requires a special talent to read books and to decipher them. Now, I usually remind people that even among European novelists, if we take James Joyce or if we take William Faulkner. William Faulkner has written in English about subjects and themes that are southern-based and about the area of the world in which he grew up. Now, how many of the characters about whom William Faulkner has written, how many of them will have been able to read William Faulkner? What percentage of the people in those small little Oxford, in that small little hamlet, in that small little hamlets, what percentage would have been able to read these books? Question one. Question two, how many Irish persons are able to read Joyce? So the question is a non-starter. It doesn't interest me. What interests me is whether or not what I write, the content of the books, share a given concern with the things that preoccupy my people. And they do.
You are from a country, Somalia, in which so many people have had to flee the country because of dictatorship, because of famine, because of civil war. It's a country in which so many people have been uprooted.
Famines and dictatorships and civil wars are all one and the same thing. And therefore, Somalis have been fleeing the same phenomena And it is only through experiencing this, by simply admitting that the dictatorships were monsters given birth to by the Somali society itself, and that famines are to do with failures of a societal vision, and that civil wars are an expression of a mental disorder, a society that has gone insane. They are all the same thing, and therefore I wouldn't, in fact, talk about these three things as being separate. For me, they are linked, and they will always, forever remain linked. I have always held the view that it's when your country dies inside your heart that you flee your country. Somalia died in the hearts of very many Somalis years and years ago.
What would it take for Somalia to be the country you really wanted to live in again?
Well, Somalia will have to be reborn in the hearts and minds of its people. The Somali woman will have to take pride in her being Somali, which means that the male order of Somali society will have to take cognizance of the presence of the woman as an equal. Now, this is a tall order, because killing a country in the minds and hearts of people takes a shorter time than for this country to be given birth again. And the reason is because when people have lost their self-pride, when people can't think anymore who they are, when the mental disorder is such that they don't know where to turn, when there are no visionaries leading them onto greener pastures of peace, then it's a tragic country, and nothing can be done for, I suppose, quite some time. And yet I am going back as soon as it's possible to take part in the reconstruction of Somalia, not only the buildings, reconstruction of the buildings and the infrastructure, the economic and educational infrastructure, but to rebuild, in fact, the psyche, the person that is and will remain Somali. Because although I've lived in so many different countries, I've remained a Somali and have held a Somali passport until this day, and have always taken pride in my being Somali, because the country has never died inside of me.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much, Terry, and, well, all the best.
Nuruddin Farah is teaching this semester at Brown University. He's organized a conference of African writers which runs through the end of the week at Brown. New editions of three of Farah's novels will be published this spring by Grey Wolf Press. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Have you had enough of comic strip characters that are cute little furry creatures who make benign comments about life? Then maybe you're ready for Sparky the Wonder Penguin, the cynical, mean-spirited bird that grills George Bush on foreign policy. Coming up, we meet Sparky's creator, cartoonist Dan Perkins, otherwise known as Tom Tomorrow. And book critic John Leonard reviews a new novel by Mexican writer Carlos Fuentes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The House of Representatives has voted down a massive overhaul of the nation's banking system today. A large number of amendments turned many original supporters of the bill into opponents of the final draft. The vote was 324-89. The White House had threatened to veto the measure as well. The administration argued that the bill was a malformed version of a reform package first conceived about 10 months ago. The sticking point seemed to be banking powers, the right of banks to sell insurance and stocks and expand their activities. The bill also would have permitted bank holding companies to buy a bank outside its home state 18 months after an industry reform bill was enacted. Jury selection began in New York City today in the trial of the man accused of murdering Rabbi Meir Kahana, the head of the Jewish Defense League. NPR's Maeve Magoran has more.
The trial begins 1 year almost to the day after Kahana was killed in a New York hotel. Defendant El Said Nosair, an Egyptian, is accused of shooting the Zionist leader in the head after a lecture. New York City police said about 60 people demonstrated outside the courtroom today, and a scuffle erupted between members of the Jewish Defense League and supporters of Nosair. One protester was arrested for allegedly hitting a police officer on the wrist with a stick. Inside the courtroom, New York Supreme Court Justice Alvin Schlesinger turned down a defense motion that Kahana's body, which is buried in Israel, be exhumed for autopsy. Defense attorney William Kuntzler wanted the autopsy to determine the trajectory of the bullet that killed Kahana and said he would appeal the decision. Justice Schlesinger also forbade defense attorneys to ask potential jurors about their religions. Hundreds of potential jurors may be questioned before the trial's opening arguments begin. I'm Maeve Magoran in New York.
MiG jets of the Yugoslav Air Force have been in action all day in the skies over Croatia as the Serbian-dominated armed forces continue to attack urban centers in the breakaway republic. Pierre Vickery reports that Serbia is intent on capturing as much Croatian territory as possible before tomorrow's planned peace conference in the Netherlands.
Air-raid sirens bled out over many parts of Croatia as the Serbian-led Yugoslav army intensified its latest military offensive. The heaviest onslaught was on the eastern Croatian border town of Vukovar, which came under a day-long bombardment from federal fighter planes, dozens of tanks, and multiple rocket launchers. Yugoslav military leaders described the attack as a final operation to liberate the city, which has been besieged by federal forces for more than 2 months. Heavy fighting was also reported in the Adriatic port of Dubrovnik, with pro-Serbian and Croatian forces exchanging artillery and mortar fire close to the medieval walls of the city. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
Stocks closed lower on Wall Street today. The Dow fell almost 11 points to end at 3045.61. Trading was moderate. This is NPR. Surgeon General Antonia Novello escalated her campaign today against teenage consumption of alcohol. She called on industry to voluntarily change its advertising practices or face stronger action. Novello says youthful models and rap personalities are among the ad images irresponsibly aimed at American youth. She scheduled a meeting for December 11th to discuss her request with industry officials, some of whom say she has no basis for the charge that ads increase underage drinking. Novello says if industry won't comply, she'll take it as far as she can. The United Nations General Assembly today debated ways to streamline its operations. Poorer countries say the UN is such a bureaucracy they cannot get the help that they need. Linda Fasulo reports.
Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar has called for appointment of a new high-level humanitarian chief who would coordinate action by all the world body's agencies. The official would be able to provide rapid response to emergencies ranging from famine to sudden refugee movements. But although the proposal sounded like a motherhood issue, some third world countries spoke up against it. China, Mexico, Egypt, and Brazil feared that a powerful humanitarian leader might overstep national boundaries when troubled countries did not want any interference in their affairs. In spite of disagreements, however, most countries supported a $50 million revolving emergency fund that would supply ready cash when disasters struck. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
The U.S. Postal Service's Board of Governors met in private today to discuss a 1 cent increase in first-class mail rates to 30 cents a letter. The board is considering the rate increase because the Postal Service says it needs more money to offset a fall in revenue from international mail, and overall mail volume has declined. The board's decision is expected to be announced tomorrow. You're listening to National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Occasionally, a cartoonist makes the jump from alternative papers to a major daily, and the work is quirkier or more radical than you'd expect to find in the mainstream press. Dan Perkins is one of those cartoonists. His weekly comic strip, This Modern World, runs in over a dozen alternative papers, including the San Diego Reader, the Minneapolis City Pages, the Phoenix New Times, the St. Louis Riverfront Times. And it occasionally appears in the magazines The Utney Reader, Z, and the Whole Earth Review. Now his strip can also be found on the op-ed page of the San Francisco Examiner. Perkins draws the cartoons under the pseudonym Tom Tomorrow. This modern world takes on social and political issues. Some of the funniest strips are about how TV news covers those issues. Here's Perkins to read one of them.
In ancient times, our primitive ancestors huddled around the campfire in fearful ignorance of the world around them. In this modern world, however, the light of reason shines brightly as families gather around the warm glow of their television sets. And the TV is saying, coming up next on the news, terrifying, inexplicable events occurring in faraway places presented without historical or sociological context. And there's a family huddled around the TV, and the father is saying, geez, it looks pretty bad out there. And the mother says, I'm certainly glad we're safe here at home.
You know, I first saw this cartoon in the Village Voice, on the cover, I think, of a Voice literary supplement. And I thought it was a really shrewd piece of media criticism. How did you start doing as much as you've been doing about the media?
It's just sort of a fascination of mine. And a lot of people seem to just accept that the media is out there diligently reporting, and they don't really realize that oftentimes what they're reading is in effect press releases that the White House has given out. A lot of editorial cartoonists or a lot of cartoonists just sort of comment on an event. If John Sununu is misusing his White House airplane privileges, you get 500 cartoons about John Sununu taking the plane to the 7-Eleven, or if Dan Quayle does something dumb, you get 500 cartoons about Dan Quayle being dumb. But these are just sort of really surface obvious things, and what I like to do more is sort of take the event and then comment on how the media reports that event.
So you're looking as much at the system as you're looking at some individual event that went wrong.
Yeah, just sort of looking at the event and then taking one step back and looking at everyone's response to the event.
I'll tell you, if somebody gave me the assignment of coming up with a cartoon that critiques the media for giving news events without any social or historical context, I'd sure be stumped how to make that funny. I thought you really did well with that.
But what's funny is what I feel like I'm doing is just sort of stating the obvious, and the obvious is so absurd that it becomes a funny cartoon without my trying very hard.
Do you make a point of watching the news every night?
As much as I can stand. Out here you get the news, I think it's the ABC and the NBC News are staggered, so I can actually catch two different newscasts and McNeil Lehrer. I don't actually sit down specifically to watch the news, but I'm usually working at my drawing table, and I have a TV right there, and I'm usually watching it while I'm doing that.
With a name like Tom Tomorrow, people might just guess that your strip started off as a parody of futurism.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Of course, since we're on radio, I can't show your listeners my strip, but I use these old images, these old advertising images from the 40s and 50s, because they're out of context. They effectively parody themselves, you know, these blatant smiling people whose lives have been changed by underarm deodorant. And the original premise of the strip was that it was this slightly futuristic setting where consumerism and technology have run amok, and, you know, very, very different from our own world, of course. But the strip gradually evolved from that to more specific political commentary, and as I did that, it sort of came from the future into the present.
Now, how were you originally exposed to these images from a past era?
I don't know. I basically just kept running across old magazines at flea markets and stuff, and there was something about their blatancy that really struck a chord in me, that was just crying out to be appropriated.
While we're talking about consumerism, let me ask you to read your Meryl Streep cartoon.
Okay. The first panel starts off, "Hey, citizens. By now, you've almost certainly integrated Meryl Streep's advice on environmental matters into your personal lives." And there's a couple, and the man is saying, "Hey, honey, what are you doing?" And the woman is holding an apple, and she's saying, "Why, I'm washing these apples to remove contaminants, like Meryl Streep says I should." And the second panel continues the caption, "But don't you sometimes wish you knew what Meryl Streep had to say about other areas of uncertainty in life?" And a woman brushing her teeth is thinking, "Gosh, I wonder if Meryl Streep recommends this brand of toothpaste." The third panel says, "Well, wonder no longer, for now you can consult the brand new Meryl Streep Guide to Life. It's a dictionary-sized reference book featuring Meryl Streep's advice on every subject imaginable, from dental care to child-rearing to nuclear physics, just to name a few." And there's a picture of this book, Meryl Streep's Guide to Life. In the final panel, there's a couple again, and the man is saying, "I wonder if I should use drywall nails or anchor screws to secure these shelves to the wall." And the woman says, "Well, honey, let's." And then they both say, "See what Meryl says." And then the closing caption is, "The Meryl Streep Guide to Life. Meryl says, buy it."
So a great comment on celebrity political campaigns, you know, celebrities espousing the issues of the day and also telling us what toothpaste to use.
Yeah, well, you know, like, that really, the best example of that was when those three actresses that were in some movie about farms spoke to Congress about the problems of the farmer. I mean, that's that classic, "I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV."
Right. Now, and getting back to what you're doing visually in your cartoon, you're appropriating images from 1940s and 50s advertising, but then what do you do with it?
Well, it's a sort of Xerox collage process where I Xerox and I sort of paint out areas until I have a very high contrast image, and then I combine the images in whatever way that I want them for the cartoon, and then add a lot of zip tone, which is the shading film, which creates the big sort of pop art dots that I use all over everything.
Now, do you ever have copyright problems using images from advertisements?
No, we don't want anyone. No, my understanding of it is that stuff as old as I use is in public domain.
Uh-huh. Let's hope.
And just everyone pretend you didn't hear that question.
My guest is Dan Perkins, who draws the weekly comic strip This Modern World under the pseudonym Tom Tomorrow. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dan Perkins. His comic strip, This Modern World, is published in many weeklies and on the op-ed page of the San Francisco Examiner. Now, the pen name, Tom Tomorrow, tell the story of why you needed to have a pseudonym.
Okay, I was, the comic strip, the first place it ran was this small magazine which originates here in San Francisco called Processed World, which is a sort of a journal for radical office workers, which focuses on the dark side of the information age, as they say. And, you know, they were one of the first places to discuss issues like VDT safety and things like that. And I started running in this magazine 6 or 7 years ago or so. And in those days, I was doing horrible, boring temp work in offices. And a lot of the other contributors were doing this also. And there was sort of this sense that if your boss or your temp agency or whatever knew that you were contributing to this magazine with this bad attitude, you might find yourself blacklisted. So a lot of people use pseudonyms, and mine just sort of stuck.
Are you sorry you have a pseudonym now? Would you rather change it to Dan Perkins?
Not really. It still sort of works as a mnemonic. People still remember it better, and it's just sort of a fun thing. I mean, it's not like I'm in the witness protection program or anything, and you know, I'm scared of anyone finding out my real name. It's just, I mean, I do feel a little silly when walking up to someone on the street and saying, "I'm Tom Tomorrow," because to me it's so obviously a pseudonym, but I think it works well.
One of the things you've been doing with your strip lately is working with a new character named Sparky the Penguin. And whenever you see the word Sparky, there's a TM for registered trademark above it,
right.
You know, ready to merchandise. Tell me how you created.
He's sort of my anti-merchandising character.
Tell me how you created him, and then I'll have you read one of the strips that describes his creation.
Well, back 10, 15 years ago when I was actually doing cartoons, I did these cartoons about little penguins, so I always had this penguin character sort of in the back of my mind, and I started feeling sort of locked into this collage format. You know, in using these old Happy Talk advertising images, the characters I use have to be talking Happy Talk. They have to be the only way I can make fun of Republicans, who incidentally I think are evil incarnate, is to you know, have a character espouse a Republican philosophy just so cheerfully and so enthusiastically that it satirizes itself. And I was just feeling a little locked into that. I wanted a character who was sort of outside of that context, who could actually, I could use to just say what I really wanted to say. And so I started experimenting with bringing in this little penguin, and just having him say these really rude and outrageous things, and people really liked it.
Let me ask you to read the strip about Sparky's creation.
Okay. This strip is 4 panels. You have one character who's sort of a nerdy-looking guy, and he's standing next to this penguin who has these sort of punk-looking sunglasses that have a slit, like a visor, like a penguin might wear in the Arctic wasteland. And behind them on the wall is the title of the strip, This Modern World, as if they're in some sort of corporate boardroom. And that's the image that runs throughout it. And in the first panel, the guy says, "Hello, I'm Bob Friendly, director of marketing here at This Modern World. In an effort to increase the extremely low merchandising potential of this comic strip, I've decided to introduce a heartwarming and lovable new character, Sparky TM, the Wonder Penguin." In the second panel, he says, "Say, Sparky TM, wouldn't you like to share some of your harmless, irreverent witticisms with our readers? Something about your diet, perhaps? Or the trouble you have getting up in the morning?" Sparky just kind of looks at him blankly and says, "George Bush is a wanker." The third panel, Bob says, "Now, Sparky TM, we don't want you to get too political now. After all, you might offend some of our readers. Now, come on, how about regaling us with some of your easily merchandisable greeting card catchphrases?" Sparky says, "George Bush is a wanker and should be impeached." In the final panel, Bob kind of looks out at the audience and says, "Well, he's a little cantankerous, but I'm sure that won't stop you readers from purchasing large quantities of Sparky TM tie-in merchandising, will it?" And Sparky says, "Dan Quayle is a wanker, too."
What kind of characters did you have in mind that are created for their, you know, harmless, irreverent witticisms about their diet or the trouble of getting up in the morning?
Garfield the cat, most obviously, but anything like that. Just, you know, there's a lot of stuff on the comics page, a lot of comics that are, you know, basically merchandising vehicles. Let me make one more comment about this trip. This one was the first one that ran in the San Francisco Examiner when I went into that paper, and I think it made me the first commentator to call the president a wanker on the op-ed page of a major daily paper.
Did they have any problems with that? Did you?
Actually, no. They asked me to start with this one. They really liked it, which was certainly a surprise to me. But the publisher of that paper, Will Hurst, has a history of taking chances a little bit.
There's another Sparky the Penguin strip that I want you to read, and this is one where he shows up on George Bush's bed one morning.
Okay, in this one, the image, George Bush is sleeping in bed, and Sparky the Penguin is sitting on his chest with a large reel-to-reel tape recorder, and he's holding a microphone. The caption is, "Our intrepid correspondent, Sparky TM the Wonder Penguin, is on special assignment this week in Washington." And he's tapping on President Bush's shoulder, and he says, "Excuse me, Mr. President, George, yoo-hoo, wake up, you wanker." George says, what? And Sparky, in the next panel, says, "Listen, I've been wondering, why is it that the CIA, into which tens of millions of dollars are poured each year, has been caught completely off guard by many of the major political developments of the last decade or so, including the recent Soviet upheaval, the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, the collapse of the Berlin Wall, and the Iranian Revolution?" George is kind of looking at him with a question mark over his head. Sparky goes on, "Is it possibly because they've just been too damn busy? Too busy propping up corrupt Latin American dictatorships, waging undeclared wars against impoverished third world countries, running guns and smuggling drugs, cavorting with terrorists and gangsters, and generally engaging in God only knows what other unconstitutional and illegal covert activities?" And in the final panel, George kind of raises his head and looks at him and says, "Gosh, you're nowhere near as endearing as Garfield or Snoopy, are you?" And Sparky says, "I suppose not. Say, I was also wondering how you plan to deal with the humiliating disgrace which will ensue when your role in the Iran-Contra October surprise scandal is inevitably revealed."
Have you heard from, what's the creator of Garfield's name?
Oh, Jim Davis.
Yeah.
No, I doubt if he's aware that I exist.
So what are you going to do when you start getting, like, tongue-in-cheek merchandising offers to do Sparky? Like, say the strip really takes off, you know?
I think it would be wonderful to have a Sparky doll, which you would pull a cord and he would say, "George Bush is a wanker." I think that would be sort of like my cartoon come to life, and I wouldn't be troubled by that.
Dan Perkins does the weekly comic strip This Modern World under the pen name Tom Tomorrow. You can find it in many alternative weeklies and on the op-ed page of the San Francisco Examiner. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. There is a strike in South Africa. A two-day strike has been called. It may be the largest in the country's history. It's about taxes. And we have a story from Yugoslavia, where fighting is once again beginning to heat up. We're going to mop up a bit on the Madrid meeting, talk to Linda Gradstein, who's about to leave Madrid. We're going to talk about Iran and Iraq, which were not at the Madrid meeting. And in politics, the Democrats in New Hampshire had their meeting this weekend. We'll see what happened there, talk about angry voters, about referenda, and there's a big birthday coming up tomorrow, which we're going to celebrate today, Terry, Roy Rogers.
Well, happy trails. Those stories and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Carlos Fuentes is one of Mexico's best-known novelists and critics. He's won Mexico and Spain's highest literary awards. Fuentes' new novel, The Campaign, is the first in a trilogy called The Romantic Time about 19th-century revolutionary Spanish America. John Linnert has this review.
Carlos Fuentes is wicked. His last novel, Christopher Unborn, imagined the future of Mexico by rewriting the past. After such heavy duty, he seems at the start of The Campaign to be lighthearted. He will entertain us in these 246 pages with the story of Balthazar Bustos, a young Latin American romantic idealist who leaves Buenos Aires in 1810 with his head full of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, first for the Pampas, then for the mountains of Peru, then for Lima and Santiago and Panama and Venezuela, and finally Veracruz. All the while, in these 10 years, Balthasar fights the revolutionary wars of independence from the Spanish. All the while, he disabuses himself of his books and the philosophers of the French Enlightenment. All the while, he's searching for his one true Platonic love, Ophelia Salamanca, whose child he stole, for good philosophical reasons, of course. We visit not only the great cities of the South in this republic of Baroque dreams, but also volcanoes and glaciers and an Inca El Dorado. We meet revolutionary priests and crazy viceroys, gauchos and Indians, warlords and pirates, bandits and prostitutes. We also learn a lot about our hero. His mother used to talk to ants. His father, sitting on a cow's skull, asks him, "Are you capable of modifying yourself before you change the world?" He tells his friends, "I will be free in society only when I no longer need society because I myself have transformed it." He tells himself, "My danger is that I admire everything I'm not. Strength, realism, cruelty." And he's not a happy camper. "I have my guilt and my passion," he says, "but I don't have greatness." The best advice he gets is from the heretic Quintana in Mexico. "Always be a problem to your philosophers. Don't give your faith to any ruler or any philosophy without adding your confusion, your complication, your exceptions, your damned imagination." Then Balthasar learns the truth about Ophelia and the lost child, and Quintana gets his head chopped off. All of this is enormous fun. Candide instead of Don Quixote. But then we start to notice little things. For instance, one of Balthasar's mentors is the Jesuit Julian Rios, who in real life is the author of the great Latin American novel, Larva. And Balthasar Bustos is not only named for a character in Jorge Luis Borges, but seems with his weak eyes and his library, in the labyrinth, an incarnation of Borges himself. And among the Incas, who should he meet but Simón Rodríguez, the tutor of the great Simón Bolívar himself, after which he sits down with San Martín, the other great liberator of the Americas. And so we are startled into the sudden understanding that Fuentes has written a counterpoint to García Márquez, that the campaign is an alternative, a rebuttal, to the general in his labyrinth. They're at it again, these Latin American polymaths. "Real life," says Fuentes, "follows the poet's instructions, acting out what has already been written down. This inversion of metaphor is called history." This isn't true, but I wish it were. And for all his fun and games, Fuentes is quite serious about where the revolution in the Americas went wrong. There may be liberty, but there isn't equality. Certainly not for Indians and blacks.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed The Campaign by Carlos Fuentes. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Thad Kirk, and Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with actor Joe Mantegna. He stars in David Mamet's new film, Homicide. And in Godfather 3, he was the elegantly dressed mobster Joey Zaza. Also, taking pictures of the dead. It was a popular middle-class practice in the 19th and early 20th centuries. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.